So if you have questions, go ahead.
Yes, so silly ones, though. Because I was trying to go through the proof again of the fact that vector spaces are finite dimensional for 1D to QFDs, the vector space is associated.
Yeah.
And I was struggling to say something. So at some point, at some point, the definition of tensor product seemed to be important. Somehow they're, or from something that Leo was showing me, what definition of tensor product are we using for the vector category?
The algebraic one. So we say V tensor W, right? This is a something. And let's do an explicit version. We just say it's the thing which is, so it's generated as a vector space by things which look like V tensor W, right? So it's just that formal sums of things looking like this. And then we have some relations, and one of them is if I do V plus V prime.
Perfect, okay, linear and.
The relation is, for example, that this is.
Yeah. It's multilinear. It's linear on each argument. Also, you can factor out factors, scalar field factors, whatever they are.
And so on. And you can multiply, take scalars from left to right. And in particular, this means finite sums in these things. There are no infinite sums. There are no die.
That's OK. That's the crucial part.
Yes.
What did you say about finite sums? Only finite sums are allowed. Is that the
yes.
I agree. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So somehow the embedding to define the, there's an important piece where you define the embedding of the identity. What's the name? The co-evaluation there.
So there's data, right, which just maps into V tensor V star. And the important thing is
if I map the identity or the
you can
exactly.
Well, this will be mapped to some finite sum.
Okay, why does that's the part that's tricky to me. Why does that sum need to be finite? That's the part that I haven't fully.
Because every element in the tensor product is a finite sum of elements looking like this. Just the definition of the tensor product.
I know that I'm allowed to take finite sums. I don't know if that immediately implies that I'm only allowed to take finite sums. I don't know if that immediately implies that any element of the tensor product is a finite sum of other things.
I mean, this is how I define it, right? I define it to be, like I take it, the vector space defined as finite sums of things looking like this. And then I divide out some relations. But it's already, by definition, an element in there is at least representable by a finite sum of things which look like this.
Okay.
That's what the tensor product means, right?
Fair enough. I have to take it further. I'm not being fully able to see it.
The little vi tensor wj is a basis for the tensor product. So you can write anything as a finite linear combination of those.
What if I have an infinite basis? Something is stressing me out about that.
You need to, I think one thing people often confuse in particular in physics, there's this thing called a Hilbert basis, and then there's a basis. Hilbert basis means you can write everything as an infinite convergent sum of things in there. And then the basis always means you can write everything as a finite sum of basis elements.
Okay.
And here, right, it doesn't make sense to talk about convergence. These things here don't have a topology.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about convergence.
Yeah. So, I mean, you always have. What was I saying? So there are these EIs. They form a basis. And then, what?
Does it matter that they form a basis? A basis in what sense?
In the not Hilbert, the not convergent, everything is a finite sum of that. These, right? And this might be some large indexing set. And then the tensor product has a basis given by these things, right? Where I, J are both in I. So this defines the basis for the tensor product. So you can write everything as a finite sum of these things already. And then in particular, can write it as a finite sum of
those. The set containing the basis was already quite, well, not pathological, but huge.
What? This is might be uncountable or whatever, right?
Okay, fair enough. So that's why, by definition, so we're defining it in terms of these bases, not the normal, not the other bases. Okay, fair enough. And in that sense, any elements are finding some of these guys. Perfect.
Yeah.
I don't see that. Yeah.
So I can write it as a finite sum of these things, and then it, because it's finite, this implies the finiteness.
Perfect. Now I see that. And with regards to, for instance, and sorry to change topic, the one-dimensional 250s, you have points with oriented points.
Yes.
By the way, I like to draw them instead of with a point with a small line. It's a point with a line incoming, not going both ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This is like plus, right? This is minus. Something like that.
Yeah, fair enough, but I can flip plus into minus. It's not. So what I mean to say is a good drawing, I think, would be a point and a line going out, but not going through the point. You know, not like that. And now you put an arrow on that line. So that's what I was using as a.
Yeah, that's fair.
And the question was, so I have those two lines, and now I put them also in the out space. So here I would call them the in point and the out point, right? Something like that. That's the out or the minus, okay? Say I draw a point on the out and on the other side, on the right-hand side,
yeah.
And I draw, it's an out point. Let's say it has an arrow pointing out of it, but now to the left, of course, to be able to, well, whatever, to that I will join those two things somehow. What do you mean to say? So, no, wait.
Yeah, question. Do you want to draw something?
Let's make it fast. Yes. Sorry to hijack. Where is it?
Erase whatever.
So this is an out. This is an out point. Insofar as the arrow is pointing out at this point, but I will join this to something like this here to draw some sort of vortism.
Yep.
My question would be, what's the vector space associated to this guy? Is it the same vector space associated to this guy, to the v plus, since it's pointing out?
No, this would be v minus, right?
This would be v minus. That's what I want to check. So
yeah.
That's the.
Right. This thing you have drawn as a vortism from. Minus to minus. So this would be V minus as well. Right, you should think really of the point. You might think of them as being like a point and then a small neighborhood plus an orientation of the small neighborhood. And then if you end, somehow you need to see this bit. If you end somewhere. And if you start somewhere, you need to see this bit. And now if you look here, you see here you this part, and here there's the other side. It's like this definition with the colors we did.
OK, so I have to there's something I'm missing. I have to refine the notions of orientation. So for instance, when an object is final, I have to reverse its orientation.
Yes.
And when I do that,
I mean, I think we reverse orientations for the incoming sites, but this is also a bit of a convention question.
So, and when we do that, what happens to the vector space? How is the vector space compatible with the reverse orientation?
I mean, this is right. This doesn't do anything to the vector space. The vector space is somehow assigned to the point, and then to something like this, you assign a linear map. But there's nothing.
Okay.
Right. These are just objects in your category, you assign vector spaces to them, and then if you have something like this, you assign a linear map to it, which is some vortism. Right. There's no orientation reversal operation on your vector space somehow.
There is, even though the objects themselves are oriented.
Yeah.
There's no need to.
I mean, you just have two objects corresponding to the two different orientations.
Correct. Right, I'll refine my question also later. We can. Yeah. What's my idea?
More questions.
The set of like this generating set that we have now.
Yeah.
If you consider a theory that has fermions or that has like parity or no parity or things like that,
yeah.
Does that change? Like if you put some additional structure?
I mean, to talk about fermions, these things need to come with spin structures. And then already, I mean, you probably know there are two spin structures on a circle, right? Usually they're called NS and Ramond sectors. Or Ramond. I don't know. There are these two sectors. There are two spin structures on a circle, right? There's like the one which bounds the disk and another one. And so you already have two different type of objects. And then you also have different spin structures on these things. So this thing has Z many. No. but this thing has some spin structures. And then, so you get more data there. There's some spin dependence, but you already get some type of grading on the objects if you consider theories with fermions.
Okay, and if you consider theories that have some duality, the duality group also...
What do you mean with duality?
Like it's because I'm confused about like the places where I see appear Bartesian groups. Maybe this is not related to this, but I don't know, like people considering Bartesian group like with certain spin structure, but also like some SL2C duality.
Yeah. You can do. Yeah, I'm not sure how this fits in here. But if you look, like if you want to understand anomalies for these things, that's what people usually compute, I agree. But I mean, you can also look at bundled for any symmetry group on these things. And then you will get more data. You will have more circles, and they might interact with the spin structure, interestingly. So it's different. I mean, somehow, the classification is like the Bartesians will always be generated by these things, but then you have additional structures, and you need to understand the structures on the building blocks. Okay, let's start. Okay, let me maybe first say what we will do with the rest of the lecture. So next week, I'm traveling, so there will be no lecture. And then the week after, we will finish Digraph-Witten theory, and then there are two more lectures where the idea would be to just do some advanced topics related to TFTs. I have some ideas on what options are. I would send around a poll with suggestions, and then you can pick whatever you like. But also, if you have a topic you want to like to be discussed in the lecture, let me know. And then if I feel like I can say something about it, I would add it to the list. Yeah. And let me say again, no lecture next week because I'm traveling. Okay. So let's do a brief recap of what we wanted to do. So we are in the process of understanding two-dimensional topological field theories, which are symmetric monoidal functors from this two-dimensional Bartesian category to vector spaces. And last time we started by looking at the subcategory Bort 2 prime in here, where the objects are just disjoint unions of standard circles. And then we have already seen that this inclusion is an equivalence, and hence we can also just classify functors out of the simpler thing into vect. And then we have also seen that all morphisms in this category are generated under composition and disjoint union by these six things we see here. And I mean, this is the identity, which one could maybe drop, and this is like the braiding of the symmetric monoidal category, which is also not necessary to include because it's part of the structure. And now, similar to what we did in 1D, the next goal would be to understand what type of relations these things satisfy to then get a classification of field theories in terms of some algebraic structure. And that's what we start with. I already prepared the drawings because I didn't want to spend most of the lecture drawing. So the statement is, if I look at this Bartesian category, then the following relations hold in there. So for example, if I take the identity and this cap, which is now more, so this is a morphism from 1 to 2 to 1, then this is the same as the identity. Because you see these two Bartesians are diffeomorphic relative to the boundary. And it's the same as plugging in the cap on the other side. So we have a relation like this. Similarly, if I take these pair of pens, Bartesians, and stack them like this, they satisfy an associativity condition, meaning if I stack a pair of pens here and the identity, this is the same as putting one here and the identity there. And there. More relations. So there's the same just for the co-pair of pens. So just this diagram read the other direction. Just if I do this in this order or in the other order, I get the same. Then there's some commutativity for this bordism here, meaning that if I flip the in and output and apply this pair of pens, then it's the same as just applying this thing itself. And then and then again, I mean, every relation somehow shows up twice. So I actually forgot one. So every relation shows up twice. It once shows up in this direction, and then it shows up reversed. So, and the one I forgot is this one reflected. So there's like somehow one which involves this picture seen as a relation going the other direction. This is missing. But then, so this one is just 3.4 reflected, and then the new one, or the interesting one, is 3.6. This is sometimes called the Frobenius relation, and it means if I do this type of co-product and then a product, this is the same as doing the product and the co-product, and then the same in this other order. Okay, and I mean, all these relations should be, it should be clear that they hold, because we have seen last time that a bordism is completely determined by the number of holds it has and the number of in and outputs. And you can see, for example, here, like both sides have three inputs, one output, and no holds. So there must be a diffeomorphism between them. And the same is true for all these pictures. They all have the same number of inputs and outputs and holds. So there's really nothing to prove. And the interesting statement we will show next is that they are actually enough. So all, okay, let me just say here, plus reflection, equals 3.1. This is just this picture, but reflected. Okay. Okay. And now, the important statement is somehow that these relations are enough. It's like the proposition, which says like two morphisms. In board 2 prime, built out of the generators, agree if one can be, what did I, oh no, okay, if they can be related by 3.1 to 3.6. So if I write down two bordisms in my two things in my bordism category. For example, I might write down this, and then I might write down another bordism, something like this, and then the statement is, so this is composed like this, and this is And the statement is these two things are equal if I can apply a bunch of these relations to go from one to another one. And if this is impossible, then they are actually different morphisms in this broad category board. Fine. And let me do a sketch. Sketch of how one would prove this. So the idea is last time we introduced this normal form for Bordisms where we had a bunch of incoming these incoming things, then we had a bunch of holes, and then we had a bunch of outcoming things. So it was something which looked like a bunch of incoming things, then some holes, and then some outcoming thing. And we showed that every morphism looks like this. And now what we need to argue is if I have any composition of these building blocks, I can use the relations here to bring it into the standard form. And then if I have two different morphisms which give me diffeomorphic bordisms, I will be able to relate them via these relations to the standard forms, and hence I can also relate them to each other. This is somehow a generally good trick to show that some set of relations is enough to relate certain generators is to fix the standard form and then show that things can be brought to the standard form in this way. And we do this by somehow taking these things. So if my bordism has any of those, So we take these things and move them to the left. So I just try to find a bordism like this, and then I try to use these relations to move it to the left so that it's at the end. And this cannot generally work because sometimes I might hit something like this. So if we So there are a few things can happen. So if I move it to the left, what can happen is, so we try to understand this. The first thing which can happen is that we meet something which looks like this. So we either get something looking like this, or maybe something where this is on this side. So this is one of the situations which we might encounter by moving to the left. And then we just use the first relation to cancel this. And then it disappears, and we go to the next one and try to move it to the left.
But I haven't understood the philosophy yet. I know that because of the standard form, we have said something like, well, these two things are joined by something, some two-dimensional topological manifold. We can always bring it to the standard form, okay? And now you're saying, if I have two different things, I can always move these two different things through these steps. I can move them to the standard form.
Yeah, that's what we need to show.
And I don't know what makes them different to begin with.
I mean, you might just write down some composition of these things, right?
Yeah.
Something like, for example, here I write down this one composition, and here I write down a different composition.
Yes.
And we see that these two things are equal.
Yeah.
But now you could imagine to do more complicated things. Just write down like an arbitrary bordism you build by composing and taking tensor products of these generators. This might look complicated, and write down a different one. And then you ask, do they describe the same bordism in my bordism category? And this is the case if they are diffeomorphic relative boundary. So you need to see when is this the case, and this might be complicated. I mean, Here it's easy to see that they are the same, but if you write down an arbitrary huge expression in the generators, this might be complicated. And the question is somehow, what is the minimal set of relations which allow you to go from one to the other one? And the argument we try to make is, well, the relations we have given are enough to go from whatever to the standard form we used last time, so which has a bunch of incoming pair of pants, then some holes, and then some outgoing pair of pants. So if you have two things, you can both bring them to the standard form. Then if they are equal, their standard forms need to be equal. So you go from one to the standard form, and then from the standard form to the other one. So you can relate these two.
So just to clarify, so okay, so the things, the objects that I was saying are different are now consecutive applications of our ingredients in some sense. Like we have all building blocks and we built something out of them.
Yeah, you build an arbitrary expression in those, which you build by composing and tensor product.
Yeah, and we built two things. And now we want to check how do we bring it to the... So we wanted to find an algorithm that out of compositions of our arbitrary compositions of our ingredients, it's an algorithm that brings that to their standard form.
Yes.
So the first is, okay, whenever you meet, move those blocks to the left.
You start with these things and you move them to the left, and then different things go to happen. You might start moving it to the left and you hit one of these caps, right? This can happen, and then you just use this relation to make it the identity, and then it's gone. So we are done. The other thing which can happen is that we, this is like one option. The other option is we hit something like, so we have a situation which looks like this.
Yeah.
Then we get a handle and we stop. So then we stop. So we just leave this as a handle and we stop. So we stop. And then the last thing which can happen is that we have something, that we hit something looking like this, right? Or this one on top. And these are all the options. And now we can use, what can we use? Let me see what we are using. There's one more. But we have this. And I can use, what am I using? I just used the relation 3.6 to rewrite this. As this, right? And then I have moved it to the left and I can continue.
Yeah.
And then there's one more situation which might happen is that we hit, that we hit something looking like this, and I have now this type of thing. And now I somehow need to tell you how to move this thing past this bubble. So we first see, here I have two multiplications, so I can use 3.2. To rewrite this. As this thing. And now here I have this Frobenius type relation, which is now behind the board, but I can use 3.6 to rewrite it. As this.
Which is the one you just used in some sense.
Yeah, the one we used before as well. So now I again have moved this further to the left. So we have seen we can move all of these things to the left.
Yeah. And also, sorry, just to emphasize, when we talk about the building blocks, it would be like the first ingredients from left to right. Those are the things, our building blocks.
Yes.
the twisting and the identity are like we're not going to care about the
yeah.
Well, and so that's why you're saying that exhausts the possibilities. As you go to the left, you're going to find only one of these four.
Yeah.
And we exhausted all the four possibilities in which you can find those four.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's what I mean. Okay.
And if we meet a twist, we can just like twist somehow. They never show up for connected borders, and so we can kind of ignore them. And
does this mean that there's like torus with input and output somehow is central because it moves through multiplication?
Yes. This will be a central element for the algebra. We will see in a moment. So we moved all of them to the right. Then we take.
Sorry, is there a way to describe that statement?
To the left.
Well, it's a center.
It just commutes with multiplication.
I mean,
the statement is literally.
Yeah.
There's something that commutes, yeah. So, oh, you can bring it out of the multiplication. You can bring the multiplication from the input space or the output space or something? Or?
Yep. But it's like if you take the torus, you multiply it with something. It's like, yeah, it commutes with the multiplication, right?
Yeah, it seems like.
So in particular, if I would put in the unit here, then it would literally commute with the multiplication. But yeah. So and now we do the same. And the next thing is move these things to the right. So similarly, or by just taking reflections of the pictures we have here, I can take these blocks in my thing and move all of them to the right. And what will happen is I'm left with a bunch of these things on the left, a bunch of those things on the right, and then some handles in between, like these things in between. And also, I mean, you see that because it's, I should say we start with connected ones. We only care about connected ones. And then these things, they cannot be there anymore because they can only be to the left of these things for this thing to stay connected. And similar to these things, they can only be to the right of those if you want the thing to stay connected. So we have seen, this algorithm somehow takes this arbitrary element and brings it into standard form for connected borderism. And I know, this is more of a sketch, but it's somehow an algorithm how you can go to the standard form using the relations. And you should have, we should make sure that we really used all of them, but I think we did. Okay. Questions? Okay, now exactly as we did in 1D, we can read out off from this the groupoid of 2D TQ of T's. So the groupoid of 2D TQFTs with values in C is equivalent to the groupoid of commutative Frobenius algebras in C. This is just a name for the moment, and this is a groupoid with so it has objects, and an object is a list of the following data. It's an object A and C, which comes with a multiplication map, A tensor A to A. This is the value of the field theory on this borderism here. Then it has a unit, which is a map from the tensor unit to A. It has a co-product, which is a map from A to A tensor A. Maybe call this delta. And then I have a co-unit epsilon which goes from A to 1. So these are exactly, these are the values of the field theory on these four generators. This is the multiplication, co-multiplication, unit, co-unit. And then they have to satisfy a bunch of relations. So it's again, it's this A together with this data. A is the value of the field theory on a circle. And then this is the data, and then there are conditions. And the conditions are now just the relations we had before applied to these morphisms we have here. So we will just use the following shorthand. So I will, the multiplication is something which takes in two A lines and gives an A line back. I will just draw this as a dot. The co-multiplication takes in one A line and goes out to two A lines, and I will draw this also as a dot. Then the unit goes from the monoidal unit to A. So we draw this as a dot, and epsilon goes from A to the unit, which we draw as a line like this. Okay, this is just shorthand notation to write down the relations, and now the relations are the following. The first one is associativity, which means that this is equal. Then there's unitality, which means this. This is the right, this is what we get if we apply the field theory to this relation. And we get the condition here. So we get this one, this one. We get these things upside down. So we get this is equal to this, equal to this. Then we get these things upside down. Then the multiplication is required to be commutative. The co-multiplication is required to be co-commutative. And then the last relation we have is are these Frobenius type relations. Which state? So this is equal to this is equal to this. So you see, these are just translations of the relations we had up there into relations here. So for example, here we apply the co-product, which is the thing on the right there. Then we apply the product, and this is the same as product, co-product. Okay. Let me just say again, an object, so an object A and C with a multiplication, a unit, a co-multiplication, and a co-unit satisfying all these relations. That's what's called a Frobenius algebra. And then I should also say what morphisms are. So morphisms, and they are given by maps F from A to A prime, which need to satisfy the following condition. It needs, so if I look at the unit and I apply F, then this should be the unit for A prime. meaning F preserves the units, F is supposed to preserve the multiplication. And it, similarly for the co-multiplication. So it's a we have this, and if I do F, and then the co-multiplication for A prime, this is the same as doing the co-multiplication for A. It's a good place to continue. Let me say again that so the objects in here are called commutative Frobenius algebras. If we drop these two conditions, we just call them Frobenius algebras because this is the commutativity. So we call if we ignore these two conditions, we just call them a Frobenius algebra. Okay. And now there's a slightly easier way of describing Frobenius algebras in vector spaces.
Can you explain the morphisms again?
Oh yes, that was a bit quick. So the morphisms, they are given by morphisms in C from A to A prime. And then they need to be compatible with all the structure. So if I have the unit, which is a map from nothing to A, and I apply F to go to A prime, I want to get the unit for A prime. And this is, let me maybe also tell you where it comes from. Right? I have two field series, let's say there's Z and Z prime. Both of them at the empty set, they give me the same value, and they are both equal to C. And then I can look at Z on this generator to go to Z on S1. And then I go to Z on Z prime on S1. My natural transformation F is a map between these two things. So this is what is A. This is what is A prime. And then I want this diagram to commute. So this is what we call eta. This is what we call eta prime. And then it says, like, if I apply eta and then f, so this is this, I apply eta and then f, go to a prime, it's the same as just applying eta prime. And then here the condition, oh, there's actually something missing here.
But eta, and I think that what I find confusing is that eta and eta prime are objects, not morphisms.
No, I mean, they are part of an object. They are part of a Frobenius algebra, but they are themselves morphisms in C. Right? An algebra in vector spaces is a vector space together with a multiplication map, which is a linear map. Similarly, here, eta and eta prime, so these things, these dots, they are morphisms in C. So eta here is a morphism from the unit, from the monoidal unit in C to A. And the same. So. I mean, I should maybe say somewhere what they are. So the theorem is somehow the state Z of S1, this is A. Z evaluated on this is the multiplication map from A tensor A to A. Z evaluated on this is a map from 1 to A, which is what we define to be eta.
Okay, I think I used
it. Yeah, I mean, I'm now Z on this thing is delta. and Z on this is epsilon.
And C on the that crossed thing is 1?
No.
Those relations?
C on the crossing? Right. This is a map from A tensor A to A tensor A. And it's just a flip map by the condition that Z is symmetric monoidal. Meaning it sends A tensor B in here, it sends it to B tensor A. So it exchanges the tensor factors. Because this is the braiding in the broadism category, and this is the braiding in vector spaces. Oh. So we are not in vector, it's just whatever the braiding is. But in vector spaces, it would just do this.
OK, so that can be non-trivial, even if those relations, like commutative relations that you wrote there.
Yes.
OK.
It says exactly right. What it says in vector spaces is if I multiply A times B, then this relation tells me A times B should be equal to B times A, which is commutativity for the algebra.
So is there any non-trivial effect of the braiding in two dimensions?
What do you mean with non-trivial effect?
Like, is it in any way different from the from two copies of identity?
It exchanges the two components, so usually yes. Right.
But it's always symmetric, right?
It's always symmetric, yes. I mean, it's not, but the identity goes, the identity in general goes from V tensor W to itself. The braiding exchanges these two components, so it cannot. But it's otherwise, it's close to being the identity.
But you have, geometrically, you have no way to distinguish which one comes first and which one comes second.
No, that's not true, right? I mean, if you would think of this just as the picture, yes, but these things are borderism, so they come together with an embedding of their boundary. And their boundary I have like S1 union S1. And here I can talk about the first S1 and the second S1. So I can have this first one going here, the second one going there. And on the other side, the first one goes there and the second one goes there. Right. There's some ordering here. Right, and the identity would be this, where somehow the same as one goes to both sides. And here there's a different identification.
But the braiding is not an object in this group.
The braiding is not an object in there, no.
But
just
in C, right? It's,
what?
It's already in C. We don't need to add it.
What?
We don't have to add additional.
Yeah, because it's already fixed by requiring the functor to be symmetric monoidal, which just tells you the braiding needs to be mapped to the braiding.
But I'm sorry for asking again the same question.
No, that's good.
The functor is symmetric.
Yeah, the functor is symmetric monoidal.
Okay.
Meaning it preserves the braiding. Like being monoidal means that if I look at the disjoint union, that's the stay of two circuits, then this is the same as Z of one circle tensor Z of the other circle. And the braiding means just that if I apply Z to the morphism given by this braiding, this is now a map from here to the same thing. Or if these things flipped, then this is the same as just applying the braiding in the target, so in vector spaces. as I said, I mean, these relations are good because they work in an arbitrary target, but to actually build Frobenius algebras in vector spaces, there's a reformulation which is slightly easier. It's the following proposition, which says a Frobenius algebra in the category of vector spaces, vect, is equivalent. And to an algebra A equipped with something one might call a trace lambda, which goes from A to C, which satisfies the condition that if I use the multiplication for the algebra and then the trace, that this is such that this whole composition is a non-degenerate pairing. In the sense, yeah, usual definition of non-degenerate, or equivalently, we can also say that they exist a co-pairing. And this is easier to find, right? And finding an algebra which has a non-degenerate trace is easier than finding a co-product and all these type of things. Okay. So let me explain why this is true. So the idea is to start with a Frobenius algebra. So we fix some Frobenius algebra. And the goal is we want to build an algebra with non-degenerate trace. So what we do is we build a map from Frobenius algebras to algebras with non-degenerate trace. And I just claim the pair A mu eta plus epsilon, which is a map from A to C. This is an algebra with a trace in the sense stated here. So what I need to check is that this composition, if I set lambda to be epsilon, is non-degenerate. So I need to can check this by defining a co-product for the co-product for the product. Co-pairing for the product. For the pairing. Okay, let me say that again. I can check this by defining a co-pairing for the pairing. Because this will imply that it's non-degenerate. This is my pairing, which I want to check is non-degenerate. And we said data to be this. And now what we have to check is that they actually satisfy the snake relation. So we want to check that this is equal to the identity. But now I can use the Frobenius relation, which tells me that this picture here is the same as first multiplying and then co-multiplying. And then here I can use the unit and co-unit condition and see it's the identity. And then similarly for the other composition. So this is also equal to this, which implies that this is non-degenerate. Okay. So that was the easy direction. Now the slightly harder direction is if we start with an algebra lambda, which just has a trace, we want to build a Frobenius algebra from that. So it's two. And then we want to see that these two constructions are inverse to each other. So let us start with a comma lambda. See an algebra with trace. So in the sense, then, first of all, we know that this pairing is non-degenerate, so there will be some co-pairing. So let's just fix that. So we fix this co-pairing, and then what we claim is, so we fix the co-pairing to this pairing, which is unique, and now we can somehow I have a multiplication and a unit, and I want to define a co-unit and a co-multiplication. So I need to define this, and I claim this is just lambda. And then the other thing I need to define is the co-product. And I define this as co-evaluation and then a product. Okay. And now
I don't know. Where did we get the correlation from?
From the assumption that this pairing is non-degenerate, right? So here the statement is it's an algebra equipped with a trace such that this is non-degenerate, meaning that there exists a unique co-pairing corresponding to it.
I can imagine that there is some sort of dual, that it's like the vector space is a dual because of the non-degeneracy.
It's its own dual, yes.
And the co-evaluation, and somehow that must be related to the existence of the unique co-evaluation, but, or no, I don't know.
Yes. I mean.
Yeah. What's the definition of the co-evaluation given?
Right, I mean, the co-evaluation is just for an arbitrary evaluation. So if I have a map from AA, it's a unique map going in this direction so that when I do these two compositions, I get the identity. Right? That this holds. And then the co-pairing is unique. And this is exactly this delta we have. Right? There's delta which goes from C to A tensor A star, right? But now because it's Frobenius, A star is actually isomorphic to A. So this. And then this map is this thing here.
What's the relation between a Frobenius algebra and a Hopf algebra, by the way? Some symbols seem similar.
Yes.
Seem similar.
Exactly. So both of them are an algebra and a co-algebra. However, the compatibility, right? You can ask how are product and co-product related. In a Frobenius algebra, they are related via this relation, right? Called the Frobenius algebra, the Frobenius relation. And in Hopf algebra, they are related by a different condition, which says that the co-multiplication is a map of algebra. So it's something. There's something. Like this. Well, this is the bi-algebra relation, which holds in every Hopf algebra. Well, this is the Frobenius relation, which holds in every Frobenius algebra. And then the Hopf algebra has an additional structure, which is an antipode, which just doesn't have anything in the Frobenius algebra. There's a theorem which says that I think every finite dimension Hopf algebra is also a Frobenius algebra. And I mean, we already know that Frobenius algebras must be finite dimensional because they give rise to TFTs, which are finite dimensional. And now the rest So the exercise is show that this defines the Frobenius algebra and the constructions inverse to each other. And I actually think this is a nice exercise using the graphical calculus. So right here I just told you that I have this co-unit and this co-product, which I just wrote down. And now one should just check that they satisfy the Frobenius relations. Yeah. Maybe No, maybe we do one as an example. Let me see. Maybe we can do it. Anyway, so this is actually something which I think is instructive and a good way of learning the graphical calculus. Let me just conclude with a few examples. So we fix some finite group. Then there's an algebra corresponding to this, which is called the group algebra. C of G. So this is just as an algebra. It's some of the vector space generated by G. So just things look, elements in here look like a sum of some complex coefficients and elements in the group. And then the multiplication is bilinear, so it's enough to say what this is, multiplication with one element. And this is just given by the multiplication in the group. Okay. And then the statement is the group algebra is a Frobenius algebra with this trace lambda from CG to C, which sends a sum A lambda AG delta G. This just maps to the coefficient of the unit. And the statement is that this is a Frobenius algebra, in particular, this trace is non-degenerate. And then the other example is I just take n times n matrices, and as a trace I take the trace of matrices. And this is also a Frobenius algebra. Neither of them are commutative. If the group is non-abelian, then this algebra is non-commutative, and matrix algebras are only commutative if they are one-by-one matrices. So a way of getting commutative Frobenius algebras is by taking the center. So the center of any Frobenius algebra is a commutative. Frobenius algebra. And then there's some exercise, or there's one more exercise to do is so if you take a group, then the center of CG of this group algebra is a commutative Frobenius algebra, and hence there's a 2D field theory corresponding to it. And this, the exercise is to compute the partition function on closed surfaces. So, are there questions about 2D TFTs? Somehow, what I wanted to say about them.
So, yeah, just to say, we defined this game with the drawings, and then we extracted that, a 2D TFT is an assignment compatible with this composition of images, an assignment of vector spaces.
Yeah.
And for each one of those assignments, those are one-to-one correspondence in a categorical sense with some Frobenius algebras.
Yeah, commutative Frobenius algebras.
Oh, the commutative Frobenius algebra. Okay.
That's why we have to take the center here to get something computable.
Is it enough to take the center of the algebra?
Yes. So for example, if you have a Frobenius algebra which is commutative, this should imply co-commutativity.
Can you get every commutative Frobenius algebra as the center of some larger Frobenius algebra?
Yeah, but this is stupid. I mean, it's the center of itself.
Yeah.
Right, it's stupidly true. There's actually, so, I don't know. I once took an exam where someone asked, there's a categorified version which shows up in 3D, where you look at these things called empty modular tensor categories, which describe 3D theories, and they are also commutative in a sense. And there's also a notion of a center, but there it fails. Like, not everything is the center of something else. And actually, the things which are not centers are the ones which are most interesting. Everything is its own center, so it's slightly easy. More questions?
Then just to clarify, so we define then a Frobenius algebra as a separate entity then, only now to conclude that the category of 2D QFTs is what one-to-one correspondence with the category of commutative Frobenius algebra?
Yeah, so we had a theorem which is like 2D TQFTs. This is a category, and it's equivalent to the category of commutative Frobenius algebra.
Yeah, I forgot.
Indect. Yeah. So in particular, it means if I give you a commutative Frobenius algebra, there's a corresponding 2D TQFT, which you can which one can then compute.
By definition,
And how would this computation work? I mean, somehow you know what you assign to the building blocks by this equivalence, and then if you want to compute something, you pick a decomposition and you evaluate whatever the building blocks correspond to.
Yeah.
So for example, we could try to figure out what is the partition function on a torus? No?
But also just to review the exercise, the partition function and this group, what's the name of group algebra? No,
this is a group algebra, it's a Frobenius algebra, and then it centers a commutative Frobenius algebra, which will assign some number to every genus G surface. And the exercise is to compute the number.
Perfect.
For a group algebra.
So Z of that is more of a, because Z usually eats manifolds, but right now it's like the...
Ah, it's the center.
DQFT associated to that commutative Fermionism.
Yeah.
This
Z is the center.
I know what you mean, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Exactly. Ah, that's that is center. Okay, okay, okay.
Yeah, that stands for center here.
Okay, so that center, okay. Okay, right.
And then that's a commutative for me. Okay, let's figure out what, for any Frobenius algebra, what's the value on a torus. So the first, so I want to understand now not the center, but the field theory corresponding to a Frobenius algebra A on a torus. So what I do is I first need to write the torus as some composition of building, standard building blocks. So this is easy, I can just write it like this. And then I chop it up and just use the corresponding elements. So this is the same as a diagram. I do the unit, I do the co-product, then I do this, and then I do that. And we have seen that this is an evaluation, this is a co-evaluation. This is the same as the dimension of A. We also have seen that more generally, but I mean, so this map, this map will always map to some basis, and then this will multiply them together. Okay, and similarly, I mean, we get ZA, look at the sphere.
I was going to ask you on the sphere partition function.
But it's just this. It's you apply the co-unit on the unit. So this is epsilon on 1. And then for the group algebra, you see it's like this thing. So this is 1. In the case of the group algebra, right? Because the trace just extracts the coefficient of A. So we did some computations, and now, I mean, you now also at least know what to compute for higher genus things. So this would be whatever the theory assigns to a genus 2 surface, and so on. Yeah, I don't think there's any point in starting a new section, so I will stop here, and then next week we will study gauge theories with finite gauge group. So in particular, we will write down field theories in any dimension, and in dimension 2 they will recover this example. And they are really just, if the gauge group is finite dimensional, there are only finitely many gauge fields. So the path integral becomes a sum, and you can just write down the sum and just compute path integrals. This is what we will do next time, which is not next week, but in 2 weeks. Okay, thanks for listening.